When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's a new name in generative AI, and the consummate tastemaker has a flavor to watch for 2024. Motley Fool Money starts now.
Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees.
From Fool Global Headquarters, this is Motley Fool Money.
It's the Motley Fool Money Radio Show. I'm Dylan Lewis. Joining me in the studio, Motley Fool Senior Analysts Andy Cross and Ron Gross. Gentlemen, great to have you both here.
Hey, Dylan.
How you doing, Dylan?
We've got the pandemic's enduring impact on households and companies, some earnings updates from a couple Fool favorites, and of course, stocks on our radar. But we are kicking off this week with the big macro. Ron, first Friday of the month, that means we got a fresh jobs report. What did you see in the numbers?
You know, the report was a little stronger than expected, meaning more jobs were created. And the unemployment rate actually ticked down to 3.7% from 3.9%. A lot of people are focusing on that number. It's interesting to me. But more importantly, I think everyone is keeping an eye on wages as a gauge of inflation. And wages were up by 0.4% for the month and 4% from a year ago. So up for the month. But that 4% number is actually not that bad. That is not runaway inflation by any means. That is moderating, which I think people are going to like. So I think these numbers actually bode well for a soft landing. And you can quote me, although I very well may be wrong, but I do think these numbers bode well for that. The market was mixed, but generally positive on Friday as a result of these numbers. But time will tell.
I cannot wait to revisit this about 12 months from now and see exactly where we're checking in. All right, we see some uptick in the arms race for generative AI. Andy, we have this week Google parent Alphabet publicly launching Gemini, its AI model inside its chatbot Bard. Investors seem very happy to see this development. Shares up 5% this week on the news. What did you see?
Well, the timing of all this is very interesting considering the OpenAI drama that we're seeing and continue to see in the boardroom. It's this Game of Thrones contest between all of the great challenges, Google, Microsoft. We heard a lot of talk coming from Andy Jassy at AWS and at Amazon, but at AWS. This was really interesting because Google's been investing in AI for years and years and years, and they've just been outrun by OpenAI and Microsoft over the last year. They tried to come out with some Bard fireworks earlier this year. It really kind of flailed, and there's just a lot of questions about, like, what is their strategy? Well, clearly they've been investing and thinking a lot about this. They have all the leaders on board. Sundar Pichai was all about releasing this and doing a very slick video and the leaders and getting together all the different divisions. So it's a nice for shareholders and those of us who are really invested into the understanding AI. This is actually a really neat development with this Gemini 1.0 in three different phases, the Ultra, the Pro, and Nano, depending on your needs. Dylan, what I'm really excited about this is how they are going to use this at the enterprise for their clients as they think about the cloud buy-in with their clients and supporting their clients who are spending more and more money in the cloud, Google Cloud, and how those tools and their AI tools are going to drive that usage and encourage more and more adoption and usage of these tools for the Google Cloud. So overall, very impressive. Technology was very impressive, and we'll see how it all develops over the next few months.
So you mentioned the enterprise segment there, Andy, and I think one of the things that's so interesting. This is a nascent space. I think we just lapped the 1 year anniversary or the 1 year birthday of OpenAI being out there and available. On the generative AI side, I think one of the things that's very fun about the technology is it's visible. It's something you can interact with and play around with. Is there anything that you're watching or people can kind of keep an eye on as they're interacting with some of this stuff, just to see signs of people maybe taking a lead or developing in the space?
Well, let's just focus on the Google part to this. So they are talking about how over the next few months, they're going to start to integrate this into more tools like search. Now, the pro version is their backbone to Bard search, which has been available for a while. Now it's getting even more and more enhanced. But you'll start to see this across the entire platform of the tools that we use, even consumers, let alone clients, or let alone enterprises. So you'll start to see more and more of adoption of these tools into the tools that we use every day. I'm really interested to see what Apple does, because got Siri search and Siri usage and their AI tools there are on the consumer side leave a lot to be desired. So it'll be very interesting to see how they innovate in that space. But look for more and more AI tools integrated throughout the tools like Gmail or whatever you might use as a consumer, because that will be a really litmus test on how fast this is adopting in the consumer side.
I just got a new iPhone and it crippled me for like a week until I could figure it all out. So I can only imagine what AI has got coming for me.
I don't think anyone's pounding the table on Siri's capabilities. I think Siri does leave a lot to be desired, as you were saying there, Andy. All right, from one era of technology to another, we have a curious development over at GameStop. Ron, this week, the meme stock company announced that company cash can be used to invest in public companies by company leadership, Ryan Cohen. I'm a little curious. This sounds like an odd update. Is this an odd update?
It's an odd update. It's certainly not common. As one esteemed analyst called it, inane and alarming. GameStop should be focusing on turning its business. If they believe in that business, perhaps they should be buying back stock with their cash rather than making other equity investments. But that turnaround is not going well. Recent sales were down 9%, 25% since the same period in 2019. Losses did narrow. I'll give them that. Aggressive cost cuts, store closing in Europe, that helped. But it's certainly not growing the business. It's shrinking the business, which, if necessary, so be it. But I guess they're looking for some other ways to generate value. This is tricky. They got to be careful. They could end up violating the Investment Act if more than 40% of their assets are in investments that are unrelated to their actual business. So I'm sure their lawyers have informed them, but take it from me that you should be careful and keep an eye on that number.
One of the other things I saw related to this update was Ryan Cohen will also be able to invest alongside GameStop personally in anything that he's directing the company to own. It seems to me like so much of the GameStop story is a bet on Ryan Cohen, and we've seen a lot of interest in that. To me, this only further solidifies that is kind of the case here.
Yeah, and I'll remind folks that Ryan is and his company is still the largest shareholder of Chewy, largest shareholder of GameStop. He's somewhat famous for the meme craze, trading in and out of GameStop, Bed Bath & Beyond. So he's an interesting figure. Disclosure. If he's buying stock alongside a public company, I think everyone needs to know when and how much and why. And if these things are happening behind the scenes, it will not go well.
All right, coming up after the break, more Chewy. We've got an earnings rundown and follow-up on last week's radar stocks. Stay right here. This is Motley Fool Money. Welcome back to Motley Fool Money. I'm Dylan Lewis here in the studio with Andy Cross and Ron Gross. We've got an earnings parade and some updates from a couple different companies that are heavily followed in the Fool universe. Andy, we're going to kick off with DocuSign. It was our colleague Jason Moser's radar stock last week. Now we've got some updated earnings. What did you see in the company's results?
Well, there wasn't a lot baked into the expectations coming to DocuSign. The stock has really struggled here. Decent results showing, you know, healthy growth in revenues and a better margin picture. We'll get to that in a second. But billings continue to be on the lower side, and the forecast of low single-digit growth is not super exciting. New CEO Alan Thygesen continues to try to position DocuSign as the leader in both e-signature and more about contract lifecycle management. So he's invested a lot in that, and he continues wants to grow the business above that 10% range. We'll see how he does. So revenues up 8.5% to $700 million. Billings, as I mentioned, up 5% to $692 million. They added 36,000 customers. That was up 11%. Direct digital continues to be the largest contributor, and the direct consumer growth, so just like through the digital platform and directly with DocuSign, was up 15%. Steady gross margins at 80%. What you're seeing now with DocuSign is really a focus on smart investments. They continue to invest a lot in R&D. Research and development was 19% of sales. That's consistent as for the past couple quarters. Their operating margin was up 20, was up, their operating income was up 27%. Their operating margin was 27% versus 23%. Cash earnings were 79% versus 57%. So you're seeing a lot of investment go into managing the business, driving profits, and driving cash flow. So the challenge is that the macro environment is not doing a lot for them right now. They are seeing some of their verticals improving and stabilizing from the first half, especially in things like real estate and some of the other verticals like technology. But overall, it's no longer the 20% growth story that DocuSign used to be, Dylan. It's much more about that single to high digit kind of grower. And Thigason and his team really want to get it back above 10%. International will be a big driver of that. So we'll have to watch what we do. You basically got a value stock trading at 17 times free cash flow, can grow in the mid-single digits. That's a pretty good deal at this price.
So it's looking attractive to you, Andy?
Yeah, I think I bought a little bit earlier this summer. I'm down a little bit on it, and I think long-term you'll do pretty well. Nothing like a fireworks like you may have seen back during the COVID days, of course.
Ron, we also have an update on the state of Fido. Pet supplier Chewy posted earnings this week. This is a stock that bottomed out a bit in 2023. Are there positive signs in the earnings report?
I think if you look under the hood, there are some positive signs. The stock initially got whacked. The investors just did not like what they saw, but the stock kind of rebounded as the week progressed. They did miss on both the top and bottom lines, which I think caused that knee-jerk reaction. But I'll point out some interesting metrics here. So net sales were up 8%, and management noted that Chewy gained market share during the period. Pretty good. Net sales per active customer up nearly 14%. That means their average customer is spending more money on the platform than in previous periods. Also important, and auto ship customer sales were up 13% and now represent over 76% of net sales. So you have customers spending more per customer, and that recurring revenue is occurring because they're mostly all on auto ship. That can be a powerful combination. They ended the third quarter with about 20.3 million active customers. That is down slightly sequentially from the second quarter. Let's keep an eye on that. But margins did widen. Company reported a loss of around $36 million. Adjusted EBITDA, if that's your cup of tea, Dylan, was $82.1 million positive, up $11.7 million. You can maybe take away some things there that at least from a cash flow perspective, not taking stock-based compensation into account, that some things are traveling in the right direction. EBITDA margins, adjusted EBITDA margins, 3%, so thin. But there should be some leverage in this business as they continue to grow, and there's room for that. 0.7 times sales from a stock perspective. I'm not a sales ratio kind of guy, but that could indicate some cheapness.
Wow, a sales multiple and adjusted earnings numbers?
You're
Ron,
welcome.
What's going
You're
on
welcome.
Over there?
Anything for our listeners.
One of the things that jumped out to me in this report was the company really emphasizing its pharmacy business. I think they said it's about to hit a $1 billion run rate, and they are the number one pet pharmacy in the United States. This is not a particularly old initiative. This is, I think, in year 4 or 5 for them. Ron, are you surprised by that?
It's taken them a while to get to scale, but that doesn't surprise me. I think it would. Pharmacy should be a higher margin business than their typical hard goods segment. So that could bode well for overall margins, overall profitability, and kind of buy into or make the growth story even more powerful.
From pets to people, shares of Lululemon now at an all-time high following the company's latest earnings result. Andy, what is pushing the company so high this week?
Well, interesting. After the earnings came out, the pre-market and post-market print was not really inspiring. Now we saw it just hit those all-time highs, as you mentioned. It continues to be the leader when it comes to not just athleisure, but really high-end apparel. The apparel market in general is not doing that well, but Lululemon continues to do well. Revenue is up 18%. The women's business was up 19%, men up 15%, their accessories up 29%. International was a big driver, up more than 49%. North America up 12%, so a little bit on the lower side, of course, is much more saturated. Their comp sales were up 13%, 9% on the store side, 19% on the e-commerce side. They added 63 new stores over the past year. That's about 17% increase in square footage. They had a record Thanksgiving Day sales cycle. The U.S. market share continues to grow. It was up about 1.5 percentage points. And you're seeing improvements on the gross profit and the operating profit side, too. So, Dylan, it's a business that continues to speak to their customer, continues to deliver what those customers want, and those customers are continuing to show willingness to pay for it. Now, there was some concern a little bit on the guidance, especially, I think, on some of the men's side, that maybe men are becoming a little bit more particular about what they may spend on and how much they're willing to spend. So I think that was a little bit of concern when you look forward to the growth prospects for the fourth quarter, which is earnings sales growth of about 13 to 14%. But overall, this is just a winning business. Their strategy continues to win. They have that new deal with Peloton that is hopefully going to open up more and more of the market for those who are using Peloton. And that's why the stock is really at an all-time high, continues to do well.
I don't know if this is a bellwether, but Ron Gross owns two pairs of Lululemon pants and hasn't ever seen a yoga studio. So they have golf pants, they've got joggers. Don't sleep on the men's
store. Yeah, and their inventories were down 4%. So it's not like a discounting story. They are continuing to sell very high margin profit product, and their customers are buying it, like Ron Gross.
And I believe they're on your shopping list as well, Andy.
They are on my shopping list. I've been looking for some pants, and it's about time that I stepped up, because I've been a little bit more of a discount kind of guy, but I think now Lululemon may be the way to go. My brother uses Lululemon, so he listens to the show there. So, Gordo, there you go.
You know, we are opening ourselves up to advertising at some point. We may consider Lululemon as a sponsor. We have some host red experience right there for you. How perfect is that? All right, we are going to wrap up our earnings updates in the grocery aisle. J.M. Smucker up 7% on strong earnings this week. Ron, moms like you continue to choose Jif even at higher prices.
And Uncrustables, it turns out. Which was very strong. This is an interesting story to me, and I think it's one investors should maybe take a look at. The stock got whacked back in September on the announcement that they were going to acquire Hostess for $5.6 billion. And, you know, perhaps they thought the fit was interesting or they were paying too much, but it created a situation where the stock was perhaps inexpensive. But they've got a great stable of brands. You know, it's Folgers and Smucker's and Jif and Milk-Bone. It's a family-run business. CEO is fifth generation of Smucker, which is better than Gross. So it's an interesting company to me, and they're divesting some of their less profitable brands. The quarter, not bad. Comp sales up 7%. The Uncrustables was a hot spot there, 22% increase. Sales volume contributed 4%. Price contributed 3%. So you've got both higher volumes and the ability to pass along price increases, rather powerful in my opinion. Gross margins widened pretty significantly and profits were strong. They did lower their guidance a little bit of fear about the macro economy and spending out there. But based on current forward guidance, only 12 and a half times forward guidance, they've increased their dividend for 21 consecutive years, 3.8% yield, not too shabby. I do think some risks include we're moving towards a healthier eating situation. The weight loss drugs are going to be very interesting for companies like Smucker and Hostess. But I do think this is one worth looking at.
So Andy mentioned earlier that there was a kind of surprisingly good quarter for Lululemon. We're seeing surprisingly strong results on the grocery aisle as well. Do you feel like the long-awaited consumer tightening is maybe taking a little bit longer or may not materialize, Ron?
Consumers right now are still in this shying away from big ticket non-discretionary items and focusing on the food items that they need to feed their family. The peanut butters, the jellies, the Uncrustables, and the coffee, which we all desperately
can't give that up.
So that'll be interesting to watch, because the consumer, I think, is also taxed. Savings accounts are coming down, credit card balances are going up. This all feeds into this whole big macro thing about are we going through a recession or a soft landing? But I think stable brands like Smucker owns are going to be good consistently over long periods of time.
All right, Ron Gross, Andy Cross, fellows, we're going to catch you guys a little bit later in the show. Up next, we've got a look at the business and economic fragility that the COVID pandemic exposed and how we might fix it. Stay right here. You're listening to Motley Fool Money.
There you are. Come on, baby. Don't you wanna dance with me? Ricky Mulvey with Motley Fool Money here to tell you about a vehicle that is redefining sporting luxury, the Range Rover Sport. The first thing I noticed when I sat down in the driver's seat is that I felt like I was in a cockpit. You're up off the ground in a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. I also really appreciated the overhead 360-degree camera view that let me know exactly where I was going as I was backing out of the parking space. I went for a drive in the Range Rover Sport out in Littleton, Colorado, and tested the accelerator just a little bit and felt the performance and agility. It's an instinctive drive with engaging on-road dynamics and effortless composure. To put it plainly, the Range Rover Sport is powerful. It's also quiet and comfortable. Advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable yet. I'd like to invite you to visit LandRoverUSA.com to learn more about the Range Rover Sport.
Welcome back to Motley Fool Money. I'm Dylan Lewis. We're still wading our way out of the pandemic, but we're now in a position to process and reflect what happened and the response. Journalist and author Bethany McLean has made a career out of sorting through complicated and often calamitous events, and her latest book, The Big Fail, takes a look at the last 3 years, how we responded to COVID, and the lasting effects on households, businesses, and the economy. Motley Fool Money's Deidre Woolard spoke with McLean about her book and the issues she's paying attention to as we head into 2024.
In your writing career, one of the things it feels like to me from the outside reading your books is you've kind of focused on uncovering the decisions that lead to big outcomes, often not the best outcomes. Here, some of this was the urgency, I think, around the pandemic led to poor decision-making. And I think that's a theme I've seen in your other books, too. I know why I make stupid decisions based on urgency, but why does it happen so much in business, given that we've got information, you've got preparation, and yet when the moment comes, bad mistakes just keep happening?
I think on some level, it's completely understandable. And back to the first question you asked, because when what is inconceivable happens, even if it was always a possibility of which we should have been aware, we're all just shocked. And I often say that the best lesson anybody can learn is that one we learned in kindergarten, you know, use your imagination, because these things that you think in advance, oh, that can't happen, that won't happen, too often they do, whether it's the global financial crisis or the pandemic, right? They do happen. And I forgive everybody some degree of shock when that happens. But I also think the reality of our system, and it's why I find some of the lessons from the pandemic are not just about the pandemic. They're about our society and our business, the way business operates. We've just stretched everything to the breaking point in the name of efficiency, in the name of profits. And I think we've forgotten that resiliency matters too. And so when something unexpected happens, it turns out often that there's not a lot of padding in the system to absorb it. And so people panic, in part because of the lack of padding. So one thing that exacerbated the panic, one concrete example, is we couldn't get PPE because we'd outsourced all the manufacturing of PPE to China. And we couldn't just turn on a dime and start manufacturing masks and gowns and all the other things and gloves and all the other things we needed here. And so that's an example of just lack of resiliency as a result of having made things very, very fragile in the name of increased efficiency and profits. And there's a cost to that. We forget that there's a cost to that.
You have a chapter on the Fed's moves and quantitative easing. There was this line that stuck with me about how the enormity of the Fed's rescue sort of revealed the fragility of our financial system. And I think that's a theme throughout the book about the fragility of various systems. And just how much the Fed had to prop up everything, I think, to the extent that a lot of us are unaware of, and you go into detail in the book. But it feels to me, as you know, as an observer, like the government can't do this indefinitely, but companies sort of assume that it will. So are these kind of short-term fixes for long-term problems in the financial market as a whole?
I think that's so well said. And the theme of the book is fragility, and I fragility in so many of our systems. But yes, I don't think people, because the Fed stepped in such a massive way in the spring of 2020, we've all just said, okay, great, the Fed fixed it all. It's not a problem. but it really is, because every time there's been an issue, whether it's long-term capital management, then the global financial crisis, now the pandemic, the Fed has had to step in a bigger and bigger way, really stretching the limits of its power. And in some ways, not legally, but in some ways exceeding the bounds of its authority, in that the Fed is supposed to be the lender of last resort to the regulated banking system. We all talked a lot about the shadow banking system after the global financial crisis. The shadow banking system got many times bigger. It didn't shrink. And most of the Fed's rescue in the spring of 2020 was due to problems in the shadow banking system, which supposedly the reforms after the financial crisis were going to help fix that. And so the problem is twofold. One is just sort of more of an intellectual issue. Like, do you want the Fed having to step in a bigger and bigger way in order to fix problems that are supposedly outside the Fed's purview? What does that mean about how fragile our system is? But the sort of more existential question is, what happens if it doesn't work? What happens if the Fed can't, now that the markets, everyone expects the Fed can always fix it, what happens if the Fed can't fix it? Then what do we do?
Yeah, that is a big concern. And the other aspect of it too, the Paycheck Protection Program and the PPP, like, looking back on that system, you know, certainly we had some of the scandals with large companies, you know, taking money and then giving it back. But do you think large companies, it seems like the funnel of there was kind of broken in terms of being able to get the money to the right places. Is that something that you see has been fixed at all? Or do you think if we end up in a similar situation again, we'll have the same problem of not knowing, you know, it all becomes a black box. We don't know where the money's going.
Yeah, I think it is a big problem in an economy that is so tied to the capital markets. The capital markets are just set up. It's innate in the way it's structured that anything that benefits the capital markets is going to benefit big companies, not small companies, and it's going to benefit the rich and not the poor. So that's part of why our book, that's part of the subtitle of our book, who America Helps and Who It Leaves Behind. Because if you have a massive rescue program like the Fed did, then you're going to make borrowing money really cheap for really big companies, but it doesn't do anything for the local restaurant or the small business down the block. And you're going to do a lot to increase asset prices for those who own assets, which are the wealthy in our society, but you're not, that doesn't do much. In fact, if anything, that's negative as inflation sets in for those at the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And so we have to think differently in a society where our means of monetary disbursement has been through the Fed. If that's the way it's going to be, then we have to think differently about about how that plays out and what that means.
Let's talk a little bit about the vaccines, because, you know, making a vaccine certainly isn't easy, not always profitable. So, I mean, what happened? I mean, it's pretty impressive, but looking at it, one of the things that I was really fascinated by was the different companies and sort of how they are now. Because for like a Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson, you know, these are big companies and then making a big move. But Moderna, you take a company that was, you know, still in startup phase, not really having a product out there, and they go from being this minor biotech to now this major player. But now they're on the other side of this. And, you know, I'm sort of watching it from an investment perspective. I'm really watching what's next for them. What did you learn about it covering it from the journalistic side?
So I thought the vaccines were actually an inspiring part of the story and perhaps the only one. But there was a recognition on the part of at least some government officials that namely Alex Azar, who was in the Bush administration and then worked at Eli Lilly and then came back to the Trump administration as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that the private market was not going to produce a vaccine on its own, at least not on any reasonable time frame. And I think that's so important because if you're a rabid believer in the free market, you tend to think the free market will fix everything. We need a vaccine. Companies are going to produce one. And no, you have to understand the unique dynamics of every market to understand what may need to be done, what incentives may need to be set, what may need to be done differently. And so in the case of the vaccines, Azar looked at it, realized that pharmaceutical industries have grown to hate the vaccine business because it's not profitable. It's not highly profitable because governments are the major buyers, because too many times they've raced to the rescue to develop vaccines only to find out their vaccines aren't needed. They've taken a hit in the stock market. Investors have been mad. And they don't have the means to do this really quickly without government help. And so the government got involved and said, how do we set all the preconditions to make this possible? And that was Operation Warp Speed. And I think it's a huge testament to how government and the private sector can work together, and also to the importance of the rules that govern a market, to really looking at them and understanding instead of just saying, oh, the free market will take care of it. For Moderna, it's really fascinating. It was kind of a sketchy company in the run-up to the pandemic, because they hyped their products a lot, or their research a lot, and never produced anything. And so people were skeptical of them. But then they did come through with a vaccine, obviously. And the question is what that means going forward. And I've honestly heard both sides of the argument, and I'm not sure where I come out. One side of the argument is mRNA is the future. And now that we've figured out the manufacturing of an mRNA-based product, there are so many improvements that can be made. And now this opens the door to mRNA as a therapy for all these other diseases. The other argument I've heard is it's not that simple. And mRNA is still a trickster, and it's going to be more difficult than Moderna is saying. And I'm not sure we know the answer to that yet. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
I want to ask you a sort of specific business-related question, because at The Motley Fool, one of the things that our analysts look at is companies buying back stock. And you've got this line in the book about Intel saying that, you know, if Intel could reinvest some of the $130 billion it spent on buybacks in two decades, it would have had a better shot of, you know, reclaiming its former glory. So right now, we're in another situation with a lot of buybacks. Do you feel like companies are making a mistake there?
So I think it's hard. I think that I'm going to give you a sort of nuanced answer, because it's really easy to say, yes, how terrible. They should be taking that money and investing in buildings. But the problem is they haven't seen anything to invest in. And so part of the problem with semiconductor manufacturing is TSMC has a huge advantage. They can do it much more cheaply. So in a world where bottom line profits were the most important thing, of course, everybody was going to outsource more and more to TSMC. And even now with the CHIPS Act, it's really unclear that semiconductors manufactured in America, things are going to be way more expensive. It's unclear that people are going to pay for them. So I think it's not as simple as bad company who took all this money and didn't invest in the U.S. It's that there's been these fundamental changes in our economy such that investing in the U.S. has not seemed like a viable option. But I think we have to look at that and understand what's going on and try to do something to address it. Because in the end, a country where everything we need is made somewhere else is a pretty, speaking of fragility, is a pretty fragile place. So, but I think the underlying issues are far more complicated than buybacks are bad.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing about the CHIPS Act and you know, building here is just one part of it. The education to make sure that we have the workers who can, you know, that's a whole other category.
I remember talking to somebody about TSMC and hearing that in Taiwan, basically the best job you can get is go to work at TSMC. That's just amazing. That's what you aspire to. And so that creates this self-reinforcing loop, right? Where that's what people want to do. That's the best and the brightest. That's the best place to be. And how we go back and recreate that in the U.S., I don't know.
Well, last question for you. You've got this book done. I'm sure you have something else that you're working on. So what are you focused on now, and what kind of big stories are capturing your imagination?
So I wrote a piece for Business Insider about Goldman Sachs and some of the turmoil there, which was really interesting. As you mentioned, that's where I started my career. So I have a tie to the place, albeit from decades ago at this point. But I'm continuing to watch all the things that we wrote about in the book, and particularly some of the ongoing ramifications of Federal Reserve policy and what that means in the disparate regulatory regimes for regulated banks versus private equity firms and hedge funds, and how that plays out for our financial system. I think that's a really interesting question going forward. What it means that vast swaths of the market are now under the control of private equity and private credit. If they control that much, are they really private? And I think these things are really interesting questions. And then some of the divides in our society, you know, we all got fixated on that Federal Reserve survey that said the median net worth of Americans went up 37% in the pandemic. Woohoo! Isn't that great? But that number masks median, as any mathematician knows, is a tricky concept. And that number masks a lot of problems underneath it. And I just hope, I think we have a lot of fundamental problems, and I hope we can tackle some of them.
Bethany McLean's work, The Big Fail, is out now anywhere you find books. Coming up after the break, Ron Gross and Andy Cross return with a couple stocks on their radar. Stay right here. You're listening to Motley Fool Money.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me.
Herbs and spices and herbs.
As always, people on the program may have interests in the stocks they talk about, and The Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell anything based solely on what you hear. I'm Dylan Lewis, joined again by Andy Cross and Ron Gross. We're getting all kinds of previews of 2024 as 2023 comes to a close, and Spicemaker McCormick just dropped their flavor forecast for the upcoming year. According to the company, tamarind is the flavor to watch in 2024. Ron, will you be using tamarind grilling in the new year?
You know, if you're a fan of the tartaric acid in it, then it's quite a good meat tenderizer. So you could for sure use it as part of your grilling. But it's very versatile. Sweets, sours, savory dishes. It goes a lot of places. It gives a color, a yellowish color to the food. There's things you can work with.
I think that sounded a little gastronomical there, Andy. He was really getting into some serious lingo.
He's TMF gastronomical. So there you go. It's a key ingredient for pad thai. So if you like curries and you like some of those kinds of Asian dishes, of which I do, you're a fan of tamarind, even if you don't know it.
If you're keeping score at home, the flavor of the year in 2023 was a Vietnamese and Cajun style seasoning. And I don't know that I saw that popping up a ton in restaurants and in dishes, but I will say I was seeing a lot of fusion food this year, Ron.
It doesn't have a name, this so-called last year?
I think it was their own seasoning. I think they were kind of building up their own book a little bit.
Huh. I think saffron's getting the short end of the stick. Where's saffron in all of this?
Maybe that's 2025, Ron. You got to wait if you want saffron.
Give me some Old Bay.
All right, let's get over to stocks on our radar. Our man behind the glass, Dan Boyd, is going to hit you with a question. Ron, you're up first. What are you looking at this week?
I'm looking at Target, TGT. It's really interesting to me. As many know, Brian Cornell has been the driving force behind Target's past successes and the current attempt to right-size the business. He's been CEO since 2014. He was involved with the acquisition of Shipt to boost same-day deliveries. Target has definitely been struggling with their inventory mix. They were much too in big ticket items because of COVID. They didn't pivot quickly enough. There was too many discretionary items on the books. They've been working inventory out for quite some quarters now. And I think it's looking like they have it somewhat under control. They had a big controversy because of Pride Month. A lot of folks boycotted the stores there. I'm hoping that is largely behind them. Shrink does remain a concern, as it does with most retailers, theft and other inventory losses. This quarter, a modest revenue beat. Operating margins improved dramatically. They've got a 3.3% yield, 52 consecutive years of increases, trading only 14.7 times earnings versus someone like Walmart at 23 times. I think Target, if you're interested in a little bit of a turnaround, is an interesting one to look at.
Dan, a question about Target.
Ron, I'm glad you said it was a turnaround play, because Target, with all of its shrink problems, which were mostly self-inflicted, and its just, you know, litany of cheap, cheesy crap in its stores, doesn't seem like a great investment to me.
Crap being the technical term for lower price merchandise.
I think that was a comment. I don't think that was a question, just to be clear.
Understood.
All right, Andy, what is on your radar?
Yeah, changing away from the turnarounds, MongoDB, symbol MDB, provides cloud-based unstructured databases to thousands of clients. It has hundreds of developers every month that have joined its platform. It's a leading flexible cloud-based database structured software out there. Retention rates very high at 120, more than 120%. Clients with more than 100,000 annual billings is up 28% the last quarter. Their new search tool, Atlas Vector Search, allows developers to search this data and use it for all those large language models that are driving a lot of AI. The growth rates have been over, say, 40% for the past 3 years. That has now slowed, like many tech companies' recent growth has slowed. And their guidance for the fourth quarter was 19%. So not super inspiring. I think the market was hoping for a little bit better. The stock has more than doubled over the past year. So it's done very well. It sold off in that news because of some kind of the so-called whisper numbers. We're looking for a little bit higher growth in the fourth quarter. They're now starting to generate some of those, some free cash flow. Their adjusted margins, if you start backing out some of that pesky stock compensation, they're starting to show profit growth there. It's a $28 billion market cap with $700 million in cash into it. The trick here is it still sells at 17 times sales. A year ago, it sold at 8 times sales. So much different there. So still looking at it as a watch list. I don't own it, but I know a lot of Motley Fool members out there do.
Man behind the glass, DB, a question about MongoDB.
When you guys hear MongoDB, do you think about Mongo from Blazing Saddles?
100%. 100%. Ever since this company came public, that's been my thought about this
that's
company.
Great. Does that make you want to invest in it?
Well, I have not, and I wish I had, because the stock's done very well over the last few years.
All right, Dan, which one is going on your watch list this week?
Mongo, I guess. Target. I mean, the turnaround play is interesting as a concept, but every time I go into a Target, it's the same thing comes out of my mouth, which is.
On that note, that's going to do it for this week's Motley Fool Money Radio Show. The show is mixed by Dan Boyd. I'm Dylan Lewis. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. We'll